Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and open the House Committee on Revenue. We've got a number of bills that need to be addressed today, and so what the first thing I'm going to do is open a public hearing on Senate Bill 341. Senate Bill 341, authorizing the recently incorporated city to borrow against tax revenues and other anticipated income in the future fiscal period. Mary Ayala, please, from the Legislative Revenue Office.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The background on this is on this bill is that under current law, a city may only issue what's called a tax anticipation bond at the beginning of a fiscal year for revenues anticipated in that same fiscal year. Unfortunately, that doesn't help new cities such as the city of Damascus, which has an 18-month period before it will get its first set of revenues. And so this bill, currently they're working without funds. Staff is doing a lot, but they're working without funds, and they're trying to get this anticipation note or bonds issued, would like approval to do an 18-month anticipation bond, basically. And there are no other cities to date that have requested this, and so the impact, there is really no impact on this.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Forage, thank you very much. You've honored us by your presence here today. Please come forward and enter and sign in. And we recognize that you're taking valuable time away from a very important committee assignment as your chair down in education. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's my privilege to be here this afternoon. And, yes, Damascus is the newest city in the state of Oregon since the city of Kaiser was founded 22 years ago. So you might inquire, well, was this bill especially crafted for the city of Damascus? Well, that would be a yes, no. And in the event others would come into the same process that these folks out in my area have gone through, they would be faced with the same obstacle, and that is going to the trouble, the expense, the heartburn, and as I call it, the birthing process of establishing this new entity and then being left without the wherewithal, the means with which to manage and administer their new baby. They put it to a vote. They've been over 2 years in the process. They put it to a vote. It was approved by the voters overwhelmingly on November 2nd. And with that vote to incorporate and become a city, also came the opportunity to determine by their own local decisions the tax rate. Now, that's about as much as I'm going to tell you by means of introduction, because there are three wonderful gentlemen here, Mayor D. Westcott, Mayor Pro Tem John Hartsook, and City Manager Steve Rhodes, who will give you the details and specifics. And however, as I take my leave and scurry back down the hall, I would just hope to have your unanimous support for this bill so it might move expeditiously to the House floor and the city of Damascus can be on the way to paying its bills. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Representative Flores. We're honored to have you come down and take your busy time away from your busy schedule, and we invite the Honorable Mayor D. Westcott and Honorable Mayor Pro Tem John West Hartsock and Steve Rhodes, if you'd like to come forward. But other than that, I'm going to invite also Michelle Dyster from League of Oregon Cities to come forward. Michelle, can you be the rose between these?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Dyster, League of Oregon Cities. I will do my darndest.
Thank you very much.
Representative Flores did a fabulous job of introducing these folks, which was really my only reason for signing up in the first place. So I'm just going to go ahead and let them tell their story and why this bill is necessary, and I'm here to answer questions if anyone has any. So
thank you very kindly.
Hi, I'm Dee Westcott. I'm the mayor of Damascus. I've lived here all my life. In fact, my great-grandfather came into the country in 1866 and bought a half section for the princely sum of $600, which might set some land price records for Measure 37, incidentally. But I went to school in Damascus and have been there all my life. I was with the fire department for 50-some years, and we then put this together to try to have some self-determination, knowing that the urban growth boundary was going to move, that we were going to be, as I like to phrase it, bound and gagged, laying across the tracks when the train was coming around the corner. So we managed to get the city through, and as Representative Flores said, we had enormous turnout. We had 92% turnout of voters, and we passed the city with a 65-35% vote with a tax rate of $3.88, which we felt was a quite a feat in today's anti-tax climate. So we're here now to try to see if we can finance this other than the statutory limit of $5,000 to last 8 months, which has sort of been difficult. And so I'll turn this over then to John Hartsock.
Mayor Westcott, it's been so long since Oregon had a new city, 22 years, that we forgot how to do it. So, and that $5,000 hasn't been indexed since that time either.
I think that actually the $5,000, the last time it came up for review was in 1903, so it was probably passed in 1850 when the incorporation of the state happen. So.
Thank you very much. And Mayor Pro Tem Hartsock, we have your testimony, and much of it has been already elaborated. What more can you tell us about this bill?
Not a lot, except for you may wonder how we have a city manager sitting here when, in fact, we have no money. We've spent the $5,000 doing notices for our meetings. We've had the good fortune of Mr. Steve Rhodes, who was Clackamas County's administrator, and prior to that, the city manager of the city of Tualatin. He is on a contingency basis, as is our attorney, Jordan Schrader, waiting to see if we get money. So we're very blessed with that kind of help, and with the Sunrise Water District providing us space to have an office in. So
isn't it great to live in Damascus?
Yeah, we're quite frankly very overwhelmed. As Dee said, we had 65% of the voters approve a $3.88 tax base when we have a hard time getting a dime passed in other issues, and it just was that support for local control. So
great.
We appreciate your assistance.
Thank you very much, Mayor Pro Tem. Questions for these three fine folks, the mayor, Mayor Pro Tem, and League of Oregon Cities? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you. I just wanted to say congratulations on getting the city going this quickly and doing such a fine job. Thank you for being here.
Representative Boquist is recognized. Thank you, Representative Riley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm totally in support of you, but I'm curious because, you know, we haven't done this since, you know, Kaiser, and then you said 19 something or 1905. So I have a couple of curiosity questions. I mean, when you pass the tax base, did compression come into effect and actually reduce your availability to collect those taxes? And then the second following question is, I'm curious of how helpful or how positive the reception has been with the Metro government.
Both of those questions, no, it doesn't put us into compression because of where the tax base is in the area. They weren't at the $10 for local government. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the reason we are here is because of Metro. Metro tremendously involved the community in where the urban growth boundary moved. It was very proactive. If we're going to make a large move, let's make it large enough to allow a city. And they have really been very, very, very helpful. In fact, the original drafting of this bill was by Randy Tucker and very supported by the entire Metro Council.
Great.
Thank you. Follow up, any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your being here. We're honored by your presence. And thank you again, Michelle and Randy, for the work that you've done. Colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 341 and open a work session. Representative.
Mr. Chair. It's my privilege to move Senate Bill 341 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor to pass 341 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to excuse Representative Haas. He's away on other business, and with that, we could open this back up for an opportunity for him to vote later on, so that the vote would be unanimous. But with that, I will declare the vote unanimous with the exception of one missing member at this time. Bill passes to the floor, and we will assign Representative Flores to carry that to the floor, to the full House. Thank you very much, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 341. And someone will need to communicate that to Representative Flores down in Hearing Room A, or Hearing Room F, if you would, please. Thank you, Mary. We're going to open a public hearing again on House Bill 2542. 2542 is the reconnect. We have spent 2 days plus on the reconnect issues. We had some questions and there are other issues now. We invite Elizabeth Marmer to come forward and give us an update as to exactly where we are. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler, committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with House Bill 2542, what I've done is gone through and reexamined the various components of the American Jobs Creation Act and the Medicare Prescription Drug Plan in particular, and then just kind of revised these estimates. So to begin with, I think it might be helpful to kind of go through some of the key ones that have been revised and kind of look at that. And one other thing, just to kind of go through an overview as far as this one table that we saw last time with the front side being, the A's, so to speak, with the CPA's report, the components that they recommended in the A's were ones that we've already connected to in the B's. Now, the only thing I found as I started diving into the Medicare drug improvement plan was basically that there was also some estimates made for reductions in the amount of cost that employers were going to be incurring because they weren't going to have to maintain their health plan. So that was something then that I added in to that estimate that you have there. So
that made nearly $2 million worth of difference.
No, Chairman Butler, that's not on the revenue impact statement. So let me just not confuse you from the very beginning. But basically, that's on the front side, your very first page of this document. This is something we've already connected to. It was just not something that I had. And so it basically is in there, about midway down your page. It says indirect tax effect on the first page here. It's under the corporate section, so it's right before it says personal income tax revenue. Right above that says indirect tax effect from reductions in employer costs. Does everybody see that? And
that's on page two?
That's on page one.
Page one.
Very front page of this form here. Okay. Very first page right
not
here.
Not the right form.
Yeah. This is the old one, Chairman Butler. The bottom here has to say 3-2-2005. Those are the revised estimates. So you should have one of these forms that says 3-2-2005.
Elizabeth, I have an aversion to cutting down lots and lots of trees. Just one tree from time to time.
Okay, well, let's see if I have another one up here for you.
Page one, and what is the
one? I'm sure I've got it here somewhere.
Yeah, it's the one with the big table, front side of the table, but the bottom here has to say LRO 3-2-2005. That shows the revised one. So is everyone on that page?
Yes.
It's in the packet.
Okay, so then it's this line right here that says indirect tax effect from reductions in employer costs. So basically, this is going to be something we will add, and we will report this to the Office of Economic Analysis when they have their revised forecast then in May. This is something that we will be adding in because this is an additional. What we're saying is that the employer costs are going to go down because these health plans are not going to be as expensive. They're going to get federal subsidies as well as they're going to shift some of those participants to Medicare itself. And they will be paying for more of it themselves. So the employers will not have to pay as much. This then adds $7.3 million in 03-05 by AIM, $12 million in 05-07 and $15 million in 07-09 by AIM. So but just recognize this was just something that came out as I started examining this Medicare prescription drug plan, and I got a new 50-page report I got to look through. So in there, it had estimated these indirect tax effects. Now, is everybody okay with that? And then we'll move then to this next page, which shows you the changes then for the various components of the ones you need to decide whether or not you're going to connect to. And these are the ones which need legislation from House Bill 2542.
This is it.
So, now, basically, what you see here, I didn't make any changes, extraterritorial income or manufacturing. I didn't make any changes with the S-Corp. But look down a little bit further there. You'll see the incentives to reinvest foreign earnings in the United States. And that's the first one after tax reform and simplification for businesses. Now, basically, after going through that dividends deduction diagram that we had in the last hearing, and there was that one box at the bottom, there was box H, and basically in that box you were seeing there, those were dividends that were received from a variety of sources, but one of them was foreign-controlled corporations, and that's what this is getting at. So when I thought about this more, at the federal level, they're not allowing any deduction for these for the dividends that are received from a foreign-controlled corporation. But what they're going to be having then in the American Jobs Act of 2004 is they're going to be allowing now an 85% reduction at the federal level. But what happens in Oregon, if you remember from that diagram, we basically have already been providing a deduction here in Oregon for the dividends that are received from the foreign controlled corporations. So due to that fact, I did not take that in consideration the first time I did it because I just shared it from the national estimates, but I neglected to take into consideration the disconnect that we already have with federal law with these various types of dividends that are received from these foreign-controlled corporations. So the other issue is as Deborah will go through, too, when she comes testify because she's gone through some examples for you. But basically what we're doing is not – under current law is the way this American Jobs Act of 2004 separated out these foreign controlled dividends that would be received in order to provide them with this 85% deduction. Well, what happens with the way Oregon calculates is you start with federal taxable income and then you add back the dividends that are in these various Internal Revenue Code categories and sections, but what happens is these foreign controlled dividends are in a new section which we haven't connected to yet, so we wouldn't be adding them back. So we would be giving not only an 85% deduction, but then the remaining 15% of those dividends that are in the taxable income base, they would also get an 80% deduction. So you're looking at about a 97% deduction and dividends if you do not have this bill. So you already are going to be providing an even larger dividend deduction for these foreign controlled dividends received under current law, and just the way that we are disconnecting with federal law and the way they wrote this also, because they wrote these foreign controlled dividends into a new section of the IRS code which Oregon has not yet connected to as far as it being added back. So this is a section that we really need additional language for this bill to even be effective. And so basically what I did was look at what is the additional revenue then that if you decide to connect with federal law in the sense that you will not be allowing a dividends deduction for these foreign controlled dividends that are received after this window of opportunity that the federal government has provided here in the American Jobs Act of 2004. So provided that you then take the role of conforming to federal law for these dividends, then you would be receiving an additional $2.5 million in the 2005-07 biennium, an additional $3.4 million in the 2007-09 biennium. So I know this is really confusing, but basically what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we need additional amendments in order to make us conform with the federal law in the future, you know, in order to, as well as making us have only an 85% deduction and not a 97% deduction for these dividends received from foreign controlled corporations.
Which would bring us in total uniformity with federal law.
Yeah. Okay. And the main point is, you know, we had in that box H a variety of different types of dividends, and REITs was one of them, and that's what the Department of Revenue brought forward. But what this provision basically has made us examine is that in there was also these dividends received from foreign controlled corporations, and now we're giving them an 85% deduction at the federal level. What we've done is then would not even be adding them back, and we would be giving
given an even bigger deduction here in Oregon. So, you know, that's kind of the bigger question for you to wrestle with, is if you want to connect all of that box H, basically, to conform with federal law, which is to not allow a dividend deduction. But at least for this component, I had to revise this revenue impact, and so it made it positive, you know, a larger positive amount there of dividends that we could be receiving if we eliminate our already current law practice of providing them these foreign controlled dividends. A deduction.
I mean, you talk about box H. I assume that's the dividend deduction sheet on the federal page 2 of the federal 1120.
Chairman Butler, no, I'm really talking about the diagrams that we've made.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know if you guys still have it, but.
Well, I thought I had everything here, but I'm not wondering now.
Well, it's all getting jumbled together, isn't it?
There's the bill for the kit right here.
Okay. Yeah, there it is. So yeah, but basically this box H is what
okay.
I was meaning.
Right.
Yeah. And if you want, I mean, we can get more copies of that again, but just for, you know, purposes of remembering it all, what we did the last time, that diagram was trying to portray where we were disconnected in that last box where the federal is not giving any dividends deduction, but Oregon is giving a dividends deduction. The second line of that was really these dividends from foreign-controlled corporations. So basically, that's what you've got in that estimate. Then these revenue provisions under the Tax Reform and Simplification for Business Act, this one was also revised just to exclude a particular provision under the CPA report, which basically, you know, talked about these specific lease provisions which would allow an owner who was selling back to a municipal government who is already tax exempt and allow them to have the tax benefits of that lease provisions. And so this is basically removing that because after contacting several cities and TriMet and things, we don't have those kind of lease provisions here in Oregon. So I removed that particular positive amount from these estimates. And then we moved down to the Military Family Tax Relief Act of 2003, and I did revise these slightly. Also, the death benefits there, I didn't have, we're roughly at about 32 deaths since 2001, and so I revised that up slightly. And then I basically, you've got their deaths since 2001 all rolled up into your 2005-07 biennium. That's why you've got a little bit larger number there, 31,000 versus 5,000 in the 2007-09 biennium.
That's a $31,000 tax cost by extending that additional
9,000. Right, and then you've got 2002, 3, 4 all rolled up into the 507.
And this then connects us with current federal law. And if current federal law takes it to 100,000,
right. Then Chairman Butler, we're going to need an amendment, like we were talking. That's something that we can. I've got it on my list of potential amendments, and if that's something you want to connect with automatically, we're going to need to, you know, add that into the automatic connection section.
But how could that be an anticipated revenue at any level at this point? I guess I'm saying.
Well. Representative Butler, I guess I would maybe have to, you know, call around to see if that is something that, you know, maybe they consider to be, you know, pretty solid as far as legislation that will come out in the next biennium. I mean, you know, it is something you've seen quite a bit written up on. So, I mean, it's a call as far as whether or not these, you know, actually transpire within the next biennium.
Representative Bobas.
Just for the record, I mean, those numbers are actually in the present supplemental that's before Congress that will probably be passed within the next week to 10 days.
I appreciate that. My concern, Representative Boquist, is that how could the state of Oregon, how could we anticipate that, number one, that there would be that magnitude of resource available to the state of Oregon as a result of these deaths, mm-hmm. and then is it truly a lost revenue if we weren't anticipating it in the first place?
Well, Representative Butler, I think all of these, I mean, you know, I don't think we anticipated these various changes in federal law, right? I mean,
so most of them are based upon more concrete figures than the conduct, continued conduct of overseas conflicts and the deaths of Oregonians. I'm anxious about that, but also recognize that as Representative Boquist has indicated, this is part of the current action that's presently on the before our Congress right now. So.
Yeah, and Chairman Butler, you know, so everyone's clear. Like last session, when we were having various discussions on the Reconnect bill, there was, you know, various legislation going around Congress, and we were looking at all these preliminary, you know, numbers, and we went through, you know, various dividend deductions that we thought were going to transpire, and it turned out the dividends were not a deduction, they were a reduction in tax.
We call that the Hail Mary back at the Vail High School.
Yeah, so, you know, we do our best to just, as this goes through, you know, to contemplate what could be happening. And I think, obviously, if you have an amendment that puts that in there, then that's something we'll discuss then, what is the potential legislation that's out there. Okay, so basically that got changed. Above the line deduction for travel expenses, I did alter that down slightly just because of some conversation with the military department. And so everybody's clear, too. I went through and gave you all this summary too of some of the, because you asked about some kind of basic overview of some of the major components. You can use it to explain to different people about the components when you're trying to educate people on this bill. Well, just so everybody's clear, I went and did that with American Jobs Creation Act for extraterritorial income, the dividend the deduction for income attributable to U.S. production activities. And in there, I've kind of given a section there on the calculation of the revenue estimates. And then this confusing part about the investments to reinvest foreign earnings in the United States, I did give a, you know, one-page summary on that. So maybe that'll help if you have time to read through that. And then I did the federal, we'll get to this, but the federal subsidies for Medicare prescription drug plans, I gave a page on that. But then these last two pages then are the Military Act, and then if you want to know some of the more assumptions behind the military death benefits assumptions, as well as the National Guard and Reserve travel. So basically that gives you a little more, what were the various assumptions that went in to make these revenue estimates. So with the National Guard, what I got from the military department was roughly about, you know, they were going to send me some additional information too, but they thought about 900 Army National Guard members who live more than 100 miles from their home in order that's how far they had to travel for these weekend trainings. And then about 100 Air National Guard members. And then assumed it like an 8% tax rate. That's pretty standard with most of these. An average annual deduction then of like $3,600 for the Army National Guard members because they're not compensated for anything. They have to pay for their own room and board and things when they're there. But only $50 for the Air National Guard because they said they got their meals paid for and they had housing for them when they go on their trainings. And so then, as we talked about before, this impact is for those who basically had a standardized return and couldn't claim this, but also for this job-related travel expenses also subject to the 2% of adjusted gross income threshold. So they have to hit that. And so there's some that would not be able to claim this under current law because they have less than the 2% of adjusted gross income. So that's another component of this. So the revenue loss there is about $989,000, and then a reduction of $501,000. Again, there's a few years lumped into the biennium estimate for the 05-07 biennium. Now, as far as the prescription drug plan, basically with this one, it's a reduction of $9 million in the 05-07 biennium. But just so everyone's clear, I added in all the 03-05 biennium estimates, and I put them in the 05-07 biennium estimates just due to the timing of this and feeling like we probably are not going to have this be effective in law until, you know, maybe October or November of this year. So all of that comes into play when I was thinking about it some more. So I just simplified it as far as just putting these revenue estimates in the 05-07 biennium.
So there would be a phase in when you talk about not being effective until October of this year. That's a phase in?
Chairman Butler, I mean, basically if people filed in April of 2005 now and they were allowed these various components, they would have to amend a return in order to
And I'm just assuming that basically they're going to conform with current law. And if we haven't passed this bill, then these acts aren't law yet.
Then we would have amended returns to come back.
And that's where it all comes out of the 0507 biennium.
Okay.
So it's just a timing issue. Now, on the issue of grandparents and the things we discussed yesterday, and that should be a little fresher in all of our minds. So basically, with this bill, I just kind of quickly went through and tried to look at what was the to add some additional consideration of what grandparents might choose to claim the working family child care credit who hadn't claimed already, knowing that they didn't qualify under our current law for the working family child care credit. So what I did is looked at the senior population that was between 65 and 70 years old, and then I'm assuming there that those that were under 20,000 in income, and then and looking at just assuming 5% of those maybe take care of the child care expenses for their grandchildren. That added about 1,000 more people onto the people who would be eligible for that credit. And then that is why it's raised now. It was only about a million a biennium, and now it's roughly $3 million a biennium.
So it's the reason that we have a larger projected cost
in
taking care of those child care credits for those extended family members is, in fact, the extended family members.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And previously, the additional, we had estimated previously it was $1.5 million, $1.519 million. Now we're estimating the cost to be in excess of $3,100,000. And that's that additional cost is as a result of the grandparents or that extended family.
And Chairman Butler, what I did before was I just I asked the Department of Revenue to, from their audit in 2003, to just look at what were the returns that they excluded from the working family child care credit because they work as a grandparent or a foster parent and stuff. And so they weren't qualifying under that law. That only had 407 returns. So that's what I had originally based yesterday's estimate on. I was just looking at who had been excluded from the Department of Revenue. This was to try to get at some the bigger population of grandparents that potentially could be coming on and claiming this working family
And I, as I recall the conversation of yesterday, Representative Boquist at that time indicated, wait a minute, if you found this many just by going through just those that have been pitched out of the system, there is probably that additional number. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at the numbers. We're actually saying that we're doubling the previous number, which therefore, through extrapolation, we would say that 50% of the people would qualify for this this particular credit or deduction. This particular deduction I'm looking at here, making sure I have it here. It's the 16.3, I got it right. At least half of those would be grandparents or other relatives. And I think the largest number we heard yesterday was 30%, was a number that somebody threw out unscientifically. But
And I think, Representative Boquist, that we decided we couldn't extrapolate that because you had several different tax brackets. You could have some 3, 5, 7, and 9 tax brackets involved in that. So it would have been difficult to extrapolate that from just doubling the number, doubling the amount of cost to the system, doesn't necessarily mean that there's a double of the number that are taking the actual claim for credit for working grandparents providing for their grandchildren. Is that responsive to your question, Representative Boquist?
Since we can extrapolate, this is responsible for giving it, Mr. Chair.
Unless you want to go down and help Deborah count those returns at the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, before it's over, some of us may be down there helping her count those returns.
It's like washing the dishes at the restaurant after the meal. I may be down there, too. Please proceed,
okay.
Deborah.
So, Chairman Butler, basically the grand total there as far as the change for the 0507 biennium then is a reduction of $14.6 million and the 0709 biennium a reduction of $5.5 million. So basically those are the changes that I made. The other ones didn't change other than just bringing the 0305 biennium revenue impact into the 0507 biennium impact.
Colleagues, questions? Representative Haas.
Thank you. Question on the reinvesting foreign earnings. Now, Oregon already provides a permanent dividend deduction. And if we did this, and after the federal act, we would provide not only that deduction, but also a 70 or 80% deduction on the remaining dividends.
And Representative Haas, that's current law. That's if we did not pass this bill.
Okay.
We did not pass. And really, as the way House Bill 2542 is right now, it still would be the same as current law because we haven't addressed the statute that we need to in order to allow this provision to be anything other than assuming that it gets lumped into the group that gets a 70 or 80% dividend deduction. And that's just kind of an oversight in how we needed to draft 2542. The bigger question is, though, just so everyone's clear again, what I've assumed in these numbers in order to get $2.5 million in the 05-07 biennium and $3.4 million in the 07-09 biennium is assumed that after this one period of time in 2005 now, that we will be going, we'll give that 85% deduction, but then we're going to go back and we're going to allow 100% no deduction. We're assuming this is how we would generate revenue, is if we did not allow a dividend deduction for foreign-controlled dividends.
Representative, is that?
Yes. Well, one more on medical,
yes, please.
Medical savings accounts. If we didn't connect there, would there be any sort of mechanical repercussions?
Representative Haas, I think it's something that I did talk with somebody at CBO in order to get an understanding of who is going to be tracking this Medicare payment and these subsidies and stuff. And that's the real question because the department, I mean, you can put in law that you're going to add back this, you know, subsidy for Oregon as far as the calculating federal taxable income. Here in Oregon, you have to add back these federal subsidies. You can do that. The question is, can the Department of Revenue audit it? Can they really get at,
can
you know,
can we invite
this,
Deborah Buchanan, yeah, please? Let's have Deborah come forward and perhaps respond to those mechanical questions relative to the tax return. Did you bring your toolkit with you so you can take care of the mechanical questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I did not bring my toolkit with me, Mr. Chair. I should have.
Maybe a chainsaw.
That's what I had for two birthday presents in a row, a chainsaw. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, the question was, I apologize.
We're going crazy.
I am still married to the same person.
I bought my wife a new lawnmower last Thursday, but she bought me a new sewing machine, too. So.
You're still working out.
I'm sorry to distract you. The question about the federal subsidies and whether, if Oregon were to disconnect from that.
In the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act.
Assuming that, well, let me back up, Mr. Chair. Representative Haas, it could be difficult if this is simply an exclusion on the federal return and it's not reported. That makes it harder for us to determine whether or not the taxpayer is accurately reporting on the Oregon return. It's much easier when they report something on the federal return and then they deduct it on the federal return because we can see that happening. We can see that they're adding it back on the Oregon return. It again, is more difficult if it's never in income in the first place. And I don't know what the reporting requirements are for these employers, whether there's some reporting that's occurring to the federal government, whether there's something the federal government is reporting to them, but that's something we can look at and see how difficult that would be.
Thank you. I would be curious to know how that works, I guess, from the state standpoint in terms of whether that makes sense for us to stay connected to the federal tax code on that one, particularly with health care, because we have some health care problems of our own here in state and in our government, and lots of this same $90 could be used, for example, in a lot of those programs that attach themselves to federal matching money, so this $9 million could be $18 million or 60% more. And if there's not a huge mechanical issue with it, I really think that's something we should consider.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haskell will do some research on that.
Further questions? Representative Haskell, that was relative to the... let's see, that would be page 41. Is what that, I've had all of these noted on there. I just wanted to...
In the CPA form?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get through to the 1120 or the 1040 here. So this is... wait a minute. So that's coming from page 41, and that doesn't come from page 41 in the CPA report. So it's 40 and 41.
Yeah. This one, yeah.
But wait a minute, that's the exclusion of gross
right.
income from federal subsidies.
That's right.
Prescription. Oh, that's right. That's an M1 deduction on the... Okay, so that is page 41.
Okay. And Chairman Butler, I know you asked me also, when we were having this discussion,
yes.
About, whether or not drug companies
that's
here in
Texas.
Oregon, really had kind of the same proportion as... Because this is taken from national estimates, and I use 1% basically as Oregon's share. But I asked the Department of Revenue to look at... And this is going to be... So everyone's clear, it's not drug companies that are going to be getting this foreign subsidies. They may indirectly, but it's going to be the health insurance companies that provide this health insurance policies. They're the ones who are going to be selling these new policies. They're the ones who are going to be getting the subsidies then. So I had Department of Revenue look through our corporate tax returns of the health insurance companies. And surprisingly enough, when they looked at Oregon's taxable income as a portion of their federal taxable income, it was 0.99, so it was right at 1%.
Mm-hmm.
surprising.
I guess I was anxious that I thought that that Prescription Drug Improvement Modernization Act 2003 that provided that benefit limited it to a total of $5 million per company. Was that a misconception on my part? I thought there was a $5 million per company limitation.
Chairman Butler, I don't remember, but I can look that up.
Okay, well, it just seemed like that would be an extraordinary amount. But it actually, the overall cost that you had previously estimated versus where we're at actually is down considerably in the 0507.
Chairman Butler, I added those two together because I put the 0305 biennium estimate into the 0507.
I beg your pardon. You're absolutely right. So the two have been added together.
The two
of
them were added together.
Other questions?
We're just waiting for you to work this out, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. At this particular point, Elizabeth, we've got some more work to do on the on some of the definitions. Did you have a list of before?
Let me give this to you again. Maybe that would be helpful. I went through and. This is a potential amendment sheet. Christy, can you help me?
Deborah, one thing that you might be able to do that would be helpful. I don't know how Director Harchenko is approaching this whole Reconnect issue and the federal changes with regard to the various acts. But there's got to be some additional cost over in your shop relative to the implementation of all of these Oregon differences. Have we estimated any of the actual LFO costs with your analysts over there in VAM?
Mr. Chair, we have prepared a fiscal impact that I believe reflects a less than $10,000 cost from the bill itself.
But with regard, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Your question would be if we didn't.
If you did not, on if we started to segregate these, and as opposed to taking them in the aggregate, we started to segregate these issues.
Mr. Chair, that's hard to answer. I think it would depend on how you go about doing that. Again, if it's a simple dollar amount that's on the federal return that they're required to make some adjustment on the Oregon return, that's not that difficult.
Right. Just the amount draw it over in your instructions. In fact.
And we operated in that manner from the early 80s until 97. That was standard practice, that you go back and make those adjustments on the Oregon return.
Deborah, I think where that question will become more salient will be when we come back and address the issue relative to the inheritance tax. Because to administer a totally separate inheritance tax to pick up those 950,000 to 1.5 million returns, I'm anxious to know how the director anticipates trying to ratchet up your shop over there to do that.
Okay.
Elizabeth, you were referring then to the...
Yeah, Chairman Butler. Yeah, so if you want to see at least some potential amendments that we've been talking about, and if there's others that people have thought of that I haven't put on this list, let me know. But basically, to begin with House Bill 2542, we need to add the word not after it's on line 33 there of page 19, and it's basically clarifying the REITs issue. Now, obviously, if we go to a bigger... connection to federal law for all these dividends that are received, then we would not need to have this specific provision specified out there for REITs alone. And so everyone's clear, this is a pretty important section. This section 17 of the bill, it's ORS 317.267. This is really the statute that has now then been creating these dividend received deductions that are beyond what federal law allows. And this is what did not get changed and is not addressing then the issue that we were just discussing with those foreign earnings being repatriated back to Oregon parent or U.S. parent corporations. So this is a statute that would need to be revised if you were going to address that issue as well. And so that's basically further down here with the overall bigger policy treatment of just the dividends that are received here in Oregon and how are we going to conform exclusively to federal tax law. Then other issues then are dealing with whether or not you want to add some things to Oregon's rolling reconnect to the federal definition of taxable income. And then we had the amortization changes that receive the same federal tax law. We could have those in there. The CPAs, Chairman Butler, have given us some suggested language for that. So that issue could be addressed with
the email election.
Right, right. And then we've got also, as we've been discussing, changes in tax treatment of military compensation benefits. So if you wanted to include that in the rolling reconnect, then we need additional language for that.
To the potential for the 100,000.
That's right. And then changes in federal tax law definitions, and I think one we were identifying was the S corporation. So if there's any others of particular definitions that you know you would like to connect to, then that's something you might be able to add there. Also, I just put down there, we kind of have a window right now then with House Bill 2542, with the way it's drafted, it's connecting to all tax law changes that occurred at the end of December 31st, 2004, period. Okay, so then you have this window here of 2005, any changes that occur in January 1st, 2005, through the year in which we wouldn't be connecting with them. I mean, there's always the bigger, and then beginning in January 1st, 2006, you've got then the rolling reconnect beginning again.
Colleagues, so, that, as I see that, that's a major policy discussion that really needs to be held here in the committee as to what the future looks like. And I feel like I got a hand or an arm tied behind my back because I know there is a tremendous cost in administering two different tax laws. And my concern is that where we've been able to shrink down much of the administration of the Department of Revenue to as few as one person handling a large section because we just rely upon federal law, and then just have the computers tell us whether or not we've got differences, and roll out onto the federal or tax state tax audits who needs to be brought in for an examination, largely. And my concern is that. That rather than grow the Department of Revenue, we try and connect as much as we can, and together with all of the above items, and probably need to continue on and finish up your qualifying child amendment. We talked a little bit about that yesterday.
And Department of Revenue, Deborah gave me some language and stuff with some good suggestion on that issue. But that's over here on page 14, and then you've got down there the issue with the child, a child of the taxpayer. Well, you need to say, basically making it broader. It doesn't only have to be the child of the taxpayer. It's any dependent that is in under that Internal Revenue Code 132 that we've now referred to in section 152, we've now referred to further down and on the same page as far as a qualifying child. So basically, we just need to clarify that as far as it being any child that is in that category and you have a relationship established under that section 152. So that's the amendment for that portion. And again, so everyone's clear, this is a broad definition of as far as who can be a dependent. And so, that's another debatable question that if you, don't like, the revenue impact or something, or basically I was just focusing on grandparents, but, it is larger than grandparents. So everyone needs to be clear of that, and I can give you a copy of that. Federal law if you want it, but basically it can include a variety of nieces or nephew or other relatives of the taxpayer or the person who's paying those child care expenses.
Thank you very much, Debra or Elizabeth. I'm going to go ahead and stand at ease for just a moment. Paul, Elizabeth, can I just see We'll come back on the record. Thank you very much for your patience while we visited regarding the potential to proceed forward. Elizabeth, I'm going to ask that you go ahead and I'll work with you and the vice chairs to continue on the track of the reconnect, as we've basically discussed. We'll examine some of the issues here as well. But we do have one more person to come forward in this public hearing, and that's signed up, Jim Craven. Are there others that would like to testify on behalf of the reconnect as well? Oh, yeah. We'll bring Deborah back too. So, Jim, we need to hear your story. Are you sticking to it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. We were going to have a public hearing on this last week, but I think we ran into the fascinating Klamath Falls cogeneration bill and didn't quite get to my testimony. So I then rewrote it, and then Elizabeth today redid all her numbers. So please, I think the point is the same, but all those numbers that I so diligently put down on my written testimony are kind of blown out of the water today. But they're close. The point I want to make is close. Oregon for a long time, as you've heard, has had a general policy of remaining connected to the federal code for definitions of income. We supported and worked with the CPA Society back in 1997 to pass the so-called Rolling Reconnect, Permanent Reconnect Bill. We thought it was a great idea then. We still think it's a great idea. And we understand last session when we got into the severe budget pressures and some serious concern about what Congress may or may not do in terms of, quote, giving away the store and making the 0305 budget even worse, that we did disconnect last session and set a date certain that we hadn't had for several biennia. And we do deeply appreciate the remaining members of this committee who were there, Representative Berger and Representative Haas, for retaining that concept of Rolling Reconnect for issues of depreciation and pensions and retirement, because I think the point was made, even we wanted to disconnect for something Congress might do, but we didn't want everyone running two sets of books, particularly for depreciation of assets and such. So we did remain connected, and we're very thankful for that. And while it may be interesting to parse all the reasoning behind what Congress did since we last met, we're uncertain of the ultimate benefit of trying to do all that into digging into, what was it, Alaskan whaling or some of those very interesting things we heard about what Congress has done since we were last here. And I would encourage the committee to look at the pieces of paper that your staff has presented and look at the bottom line numbers and make decisions based on those rather than trying to parse the individual line items and pick and choose among minus numbers and positive numbers. And my written testimony talks about all those numbers, and I'm not going to read it because they're all wrong now. But if you look at the overall net impact, so-called front of the page, the parts A and B, the stuff that we kind of get if we don't do anything, the automatic stuff, and you look at the back of the page, the part C stuff, the impact of passing Reconnect, you get into, I think, with the new numbers, if you net the front and the back out, I think it's now a plus $2 million for 0507. It's 14 and 16, I think. The bottom line, and really I don't want you to dig into this and get all confused, but if you look at the net number, it's the 0507 number at the bottom of the page, and you turn it over and look at the net number of 0507 at the bottom of the page and net those two things out, I mean, it's a wash. It's maybe $2 million to the plus. I think when I prepared my testimony, it was a few million to the negative. One way or the other, it's somewhere in the order of 0.02% of the general fund, or 0.03% of our estimated general fund. So while there are some large numbers, if you go down this list and pick and choose, if you think of it as a net-net, and all the benefits of remaining as fully connected as possible to the federal code, and what would that mean to our total general fund and revenues that we have available for the 0507 budget balance? It seems to me that these numbers say that it comes out just about even. I'm sorry. the main issue is this. I mean, I think it is tempting, perhaps, to try to pick and choose, to try to pull isolated numbers off, to say, well, look at that dividends reinvestment thing, and that looks like $23 million. If we disconnected from that, we'd have $23 million more to spend than a budget. I mean, I do caution you to understand, as your staff pointed out last time we talked about this, these are revenue projections based on boiling down from the Federal Joint Tax Committee that sort of sets federal numbers, and then we kind of fraction down and factor down and do the best we can to say, what does this national law mean to Oregon if we connect? That's somewhat different from counting revenue that we count in the revenue forecast. I mean, it's all money, ultimately, but it's a little different from making projections of taxable dollars coming in Oregon that we know, and lottery dollars and the stuff you looked at last Friday. These are, in a sense, I mean, everything's an estimate, but these are grosser estimates based upon a federal code boiled down to Oregon. And I would caution about whether these are, you know, hard dollars spendable. If you pulled one of these boxes off, that's $27 million that we can put into K-12. I'm just not sure that that's the best route to take in this overall analysis, given, again, that the net-net, at the bottom of the, you know, at the end of the day, at the bottom of the page is summed together and remaining fully connected is essentially a wash. And we think it's more than a wash because we think of all the positive benefits of remaining fully connected to the federal code. We think it's more than a wash that nothing involving the chair here, that we don't create the CPA Full Employment Act, that people don't have to go back and do amended returns, that they don't have to keep separate books for depreciation and how they repatriate foreign earnings and how they count dividends received and all that. So we think it's a positive to remain fully connected. And at the end of the day, when the negative, or if there is no negative to the total general fund, we think it's the right thing to do, to stay as fully connected to the federal code as possible, and in a sense to do this bill as soon as we can to give tax filers as much certainty in what they're doing over the you know, coming year and two. I have one just technical question and then I'm done. On the dividends received, Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question of your staff.
Please.
Elizabeth, is what you're saying is that, you know, Oregon currently has a dividends received deduction. It's Oregon tax code. It doesn't have anything to do with federal code. The American Jobs Creation Act has created a new dividends received scheme for the United States. In your revenue projections, are you assuming that we would repeal at some point the Oregon dividends received statute?
Chairman Butler, basically with that, what I've assumed in these numbers here on this one line that was $2.5 million and stuff, the only way we're going to get that additional income is if we disconnect from our current law, okay? We're going to connect with the federal law, which does not allow any dividends deduction for those foreign-controlled corporations that provide a dividend. So we're going to connect with federal law.
We connect to federal law, but would we repeal, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, would we repeal the current dividends received deduction in the Oregon statute?
Well, for this particular provision, we're just going to have to, we've got to change the statute, the 317-267, the section 17 of this bill. That statute needs to be amended to include the dividends received from foreign controlled corporations.
Jim, do you have a copy of
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I didn't get a color one, but I do have a copy. Yes.
That was worse. This is the current. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, I do.
That I think will be demonstrative of what the proposal is to move from federal to state on page 2, Schedule C of the 1120 to arrive at a uniform deduction.
Okay.
And if you do have additional questions, I think that maybe we can arrange for you to meet with Elizabeth and kind of sort through that so that we can make sure that because, Jim, I would be interested to make sure that because of the representations you have from domestic foreign sales corporations and others, the DISCs and so forth, that we make certain that those controlled foreign corporation issues are properly addressed and we have a chance to look at maybe some of the backup numbers that we've used in revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions for Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you. Jim, I totally agree with you on trying to keep things together in one set of books. But I do think legislators do have a duty to look at what we're buying here for $18 million or $27 million, especially when it comes to tax policy that none of us had anything to do with. We didn't write these laws. We didn't change these laws on the deduction for income attributable to U.S. production overseas. So I just wonder if we could buy something for greater value with that $40 million over the next 4 years. For example, on that one, would it be better for our state to spend $40 million on research and development tax incentives instead of this? And I do think that's worthwhile to look at, even though I am parsing these and picking and choosing. But I think it's something that deserves to at least be looked at. And probably you could document or you could show me that, no, it makes more sense to do this than to R&D. But I do think that, in effect, taxpayers are spending a lot of money on this tax break, and we need to make sure that that's the best value we can get for the dollars we're spending.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I mean, we've had these conversations for a number of years, and I don't at all suggest that they're not appropriate to have these. Just two reactions. One is, even though in the parlance of the tax expenditure report, everything is an expenditure, that's what we say, some of us would differ with some of the elements in that book that are called tax expenditures, such as getting a deduction on your IRA on your federal return. We call that a tax expenditure in the book. Fair enough. Whether or not these numbers here are expendable by this body in the sense of the budget balance is something to think about. Whether, if we pick these, slice the apple and disconnect from that line, whether those are dollars actually in our hands for us to spend, it's something to think about. Nobody really knows because these are gross estimates. Just that one particular, the deduction for income attributable to U.S. production activities, I mean, the other thing to think about is the context in which that arise. In the last session, we talked a little bit about the extraterritorial tax, the extraterritorial income issue, and we said at that point that we were working on repealing that in Congress because we were being forced to by the WTO ruling. This item was passed by Congress in context with repealing the ETI. And this item, unlike some other issues that people debate about, whether we're shipping jobs offshore or whatever, this particular item is an item to help those of my companies who still manufacture in the United States. I mean, this is not an issue about rolling money to foreign lands. This helps American manufacturers who still domestically manufacture. And it was done in the context, in a sense, more targeted than the ETI, which did have overtones of offshoring and work, doing work abroad. This was designed by Congress and supported by most of our delegation here in Oregon, to help domestic manufacturers. And as you saw on the Revenue Forecast Friday, the slide from Mr. Potowski, Oregon continues to be twice as reliant upon manufacturing jobs as the average state in America. So it's a legitimate issue. I'm not saying it's not a legitimate issue. I think there is, there's both sides of it as to whether these are really dollars to spend. I don't think we would be wanting to say, well, let's disconnect and then spend the money elsewhere. And since I'm told to come here and tell you we would like to remain connected. And some of it's plus, some of it's minus. There's revenue enhancers on this page too. They're not all negative numbers, some are pluses. So
follow up for everything. Was that responsive to your?
Yes, it was. I do appreciate that, Jim. I hear what you're saying. I just think that, I just wonder if that's maybe a poor example, but if there is a better expenditure, and maybe for sake of argument, that's not $18 million in the bank, but there's some figure out there that will be subtracted from the general fund that we wouldn't be able to spend on other kind of business incentives. So That's all I was exploring.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much, Jim. Jim, relative to the overall tax expenditures, I think where Representative Hass is going, though, is that at some point we need to have a discussion relative to really painting a face on what this does to industry in Oregon and the manufacturing. As we say, fine, we're going to go ahead and make a, again, if you parse it at this particular point, an $18.6 million expenditure. The question is, what do we get out of it? What's the performance measurement? And another way of looking at it is that you're probably paying X amount of dollars in additional corporate income tax at another level in order to get this benefit of 18.6. What's our trade-off in that process? So I'd just like you to take a look at that with regard to the big picture of what some of your international clients are doing and the subsidiary companies, so that we can come back and maybe address that at some later and not too distant future time in this committee.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Jim. And Deborah, I kicked you out while we were in the process. We needed to hear that particular portion, but you were going to go through some of the mechanics of what we were doing here. And then we're going to have to work a couple of bills. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to talk about the dividends. I'd like to talk about qualifying child, but if I could, I'd like to also just get on the record another change in the bill that has to do with representation before the department. And that is on page 2 of the draft. It authorizes us to adopt rules allowing individuals to represent taxpayers before the department. And the situations we're trying to address are, for example, if I prepare the tax return for my parents and they file that return, the department adjusts the return and sends them a billing, and I look at it and I say, that's not right, let's appeal it, and I write a letter and send it in. Unless I'm a CPA or an attorney, is that a valid appeal? Because the statute doesn't authorize me to represent my parents. So we're trying to address that type of issue through rules. Another situation has come up where consultants will represent property taxpayers. They're experts, but they're not CPAs. They're not attorneys. The taxpayers ask them to do this. They contract with them. They know exactly what they're getting, but they're not covered in the statute, and under the statute, they can't represent the taxpayers.
Those expert witnesses under page 2, lines 5 through 9, would then be included there.
Yes, Mr. Chair, under rules that we would adopt. And in doing that, we would look at the federal provisions authorizing representation. I did provide a copy of the regulations in this handout that I gave you on February 22nd. So there is a copy of the federal regulation there for reference.
And my recollection is that you've already got this language, as I recall, in your real property statutes relative to testimony by appraisers and other individuals that need access to the accounts.
Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar with those statutes, are probably correct.
I think that's right, though.
So unless there are questions about the representation piece,
okay.
I would move on to the qualifying child.
Please.
And also in that handout is a fact sheet from the IRS website describing what qualifying child means. And just as a bit of background on why this is in the Reconnect bill now, following the 03 session, when we were looking at these returns that were coming in claiming the working family child care credit, we discovered that grandparents, or in some cases perhaps other relatives, were claiming the credit. We looked at the language in the statute, and we asked the attorney what was meant by child of the taxpayer. They looked at federal law, could not find a similar credit or a similar definition, and said, well, you probably are safest using just child of the taxpayer. So son, daughter, stepson, stepdaughter, that's what we limited it to. We were going to bring this issue to you and ask what you wanted. In the meantime, Congress changed the laws to adopt a uniform definition of child for at least 5 different provisions in federal tax law. And, Mr. Chair, it's my belief that even if you did not make the change that's in House Bill 2542 relating to the definition of qualifying child, our general connection to definitions in federal tax law would pick that up. So if you want something other than what is in federal law, which would be that a child is the taxpayer's child or stepchild, foster child, sibling, so that would pick up brother or sister, step-sibling, or a descendant of one of these, which would pick up grandchildren. If you do not want that definition for purposes of Oregon law, I think you would have to disconnect in some way from the federal definition.
But that would absolutely bring us uniform with regard to all tax definitions of qualifying child. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe it would.
Okay.
As the bill is drafted now.
All right. Thank you. Questions relative to the definition of qualifying child in regard. Thank you. Please proceed, Deborah.
Another provision has to do with the sales tax deduction, and you heard about this in Elizabeth's initial overview, that Congress has now passed a law allowing taxpayers for federal purposes to choose to deduct either state income tax that they pay or sales tax that they pay. And you might say, well, what does that have to do with Oregon? We don't have a sales tax. But we do have Washington residents filing returns with us. And the question would be, do you want to allow them to claim a sales tax in lieu of the state income tax? If, as the bill is drafted now, I believe that a taxpayer who claims the sales tax as an itemized deduction on the federal return would be allowed that deduction on the Oregon return.
As a non-resident filer.
Yes, yeah. Mr. Chair. And that you would need specific language in the Reconnect bill to say we're not going to allow that. The reason you might want to disallow it is, as a policy matter, if it's in lieu of an income tax, you would be giving them the same treatment you're giving the income tax, which is not deductible for Oregon. So the question is, do you want to match them up, or do you want to allow that deduction, saying it's not quite the same as a state income tax? Again, a policy question for you. And finally, Mr. Chair, on the dividend deduction, I talked on the earlier about the REIT dividend deduction, and Elizabeth mentioned these two statutes that sometimes don't seem to work that well together, that you end up with some ambiguity. The foreign dividend received deduction that is now available at the federal level is another example of perhaps what would be unintended consequences. And I passed out to you a spreadsheet that looks like this today, just as an example of what you will get under current law if you do not do House Bill 2542, if you do not do the Reconnect. I see people looking for that. No? I would offer you some extras, Mr. Chair, but I didn't bring extra copies.
Oh,
there it is.
There it is.
Thank you. So as Liz Beth explained, this is the dividend that's coming in from foreign operations for which federal law has not allowed a deduction in the past. So if companies were doing this, it was fully taxable at the federal level. The left example one shows what would happen under current Oregon law if these companies are bringing back this money and how Oregon would tax it. Now, so this is not reconnecting. This is just existing law. So you have $1 million coming in that's being picked up in federal taxable income. And again, what you need to remember is that under current law, we are connected to federal taxable income, that definition, but it's as it was defined on December 31, 2002. So under that version of the law, they did not allow it a dividend deduction. So you start off for Oregon with the $1 million of dividends. Then, as Beth mentioned, Oregon has its own deduction, which would allow an $800,000 dividend deduction for this $1 million of income, meaning $200,000 is picked up as Oregon taxable income, and the tax would be $13,200. So that's what would happen under current Oregon law. No changes. If you enact House Bill 2542 as it's drafted, that then you have moved up your connection date, and you're looking now at federal taxable income as it's defined December 31, 2004. That law says they're getting an $850,000 deduction on the federal return. That's the 85%. So they have $1 million. They deduct $850,000. They have $150,000 that they're being taxed on at the federal level. That flows through to Oregon, so that's the base that you begin with, $150,000. Then you're allowed, again, under Oregon's own statute, that 70 or 80% deduction. In this case, I've assumed it's 80%. So you get an additional $120,000 deduction, leaving $30,000 of taxable income for Oregon and tax of $1,980 on that $1 million that came into federal income. So I just wanted to explain how these two statutes are working together and perhaps giving you something you weren't anticipating. You might think that connecting is then going to give you an 85% deduction. It doesn't. It gives you the 85, but it also gives you that additional 80%. On whatever was left in federal income.
You get a 97% deduction equivalent.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger. And then
I'd like to say thank you, Deborah.
Yes.
This brought a lot of things into focus that we've been just seeing it spelled out this way. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Representative Hess.
Thank you. It looks like we've got two of these here. Isn't the idea to have just one? I mean, shouldn't we repeal Oregon's language then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I think perhaps this is something that goes back to when we connected the corporate tax to the definition of federal taxable income. I'm guessing the idea was we don't want to do what the Feds, Congress is doing as far as the dividends. We want our own treatment, but perhaps there wasn't enough recognition of how these two things work together, where you have a connection to taxable income and then you also have a connection to dividends received, deduction, and the interplay. And I think over time we've ended up with results that maybe people hadn't anticipated in that area.
Right, but Mr. Chair, it seems like we should do one or the other, but not both of these, whether we connect or don't connect. If we do, we should get rid of Oregon's. I mean, otherwise you've got two deductions. I mean,
and Deborah, some kind of a template that I suppose not adopt federal law with regard to what federal law will do what federal law has done already after December 31st, 2004, to allow the 85% deduction.
Mr. Chairman, if your goal is to allow for Oregon purposes the same deduction that's allowed on the federal return, is that the goal?
Yeah.
There would be a fairly simple language to do that, I would think.
Okay.
But I would have to get my
hands
on how to think.
We need to calculate what the effect of that is relative to the current taxation that we're collecting on that.
And Chairman Butler, that's what I did in these estimates.
I've already
basically said, if you want to go back to current law of Oregon being exactly equal to federal in the future, you know, and then just allow this 85% the same as federal, saying we're connected, just as an example one in the future, then that's what I've already done.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just one other comment. This 85% is only for a limited time. It's just a one-year period. So the additional policy question would be...
trying to repatriate those foreign earnings.
Exactly. But the additional policy question would be, do you want a different treatment in the future for all types of dividends that are included in income?
I think that double deduction is what Representative Hass is concerned about, mm-hmm. that in the future, if you want a double deduction, but that certainly isn't what it was intended. Because you'd just be connecting for that 1 year repatriation of that resource and then move back. And I mechanically don't know how you resolve that issue because you're already filing returns based upon the federal law. Because it's 2004 that was connected, wasn't it?
I was thinking it was 2005
after the enactment of the measure.
So it started on December 31st for tax returns beginning after December 31st, 2004. So you'll have some fiscal corporations filing January 31st, February 28th. So we're already in process right now of the filing of some of those returns that will have reflected the new federal law as they repatriate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Boquist.
And the effective date of that law was 22 October 04. It's 1 year prior to, 1 year after the effective date of the law.
So it's... So you'd have repatriation of money coming after October 22nd, which could include returns which will have been filed on March 15th for corporations at December 31st and on February 15th on November corporations. And technically, I guess you could have some repatriated between October 22nd and October 31st, which would have been filed in January. Okay. Further issues, Deborah?
Mr. Chairman, I believe... I'm sorry. Just one additional thing on the work, back on the Working Family Child Care Credit. I did provide you with a copy of our administrative rule as well. And if you are interested in reading this and you see any issues that cause you concern, we'd be happy to come in and talk with you perhaps at another time about how the statute has been implemented and perhaps some of the policy questions. Some that we have identified, for example, have to do with the measure of income for who qualifies for this credit. As the statute is drafted, you're looking at adjusted gross income. We have situations where a couple, married couple, cannot claim the credit because the adjusted gross income is too high, yet if they were living together without marriage and the person who has the child has a low enough income, they'd be able to take the credit. So exactly the same fact pattern except for the marriage. And also with taxpayers who are filing married separate not being able to take the credit, whereas if they were filing unmarried, they would be able to take the credit. Just policy issues for you to consider, so I thought this would provide some good examples, and if you have questions and want to talk further, I'd be happy to meet with any of you individually.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deborah. No further questions for Deborah at this time? Thank you very much. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Do you have anything more that you want to add at this time? Mm-hmm. Thank you very kindly. Colleagues, we will close the public hearing on 2542. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2030. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Deborah, on that last bill, on the last bill, let's see, did we have some revisions? Oh, it was from Jim Craven. Jim, would you update the numbers on your handout, please? And be sure to get a copy of it to Representative Olson. He'll need it when he carries this bill to the floor.
Thank you. Yes.
Masson, 2030.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you thought the previous bill was complex, wait until we talk about this one. The House Bill 2030 we talked about, unfortunately, before on January 27th, February 8th. And the last time we talked about this, it was to be amended. And the first amendment that was discussed and looked at that time was the Dash 1 amendment. That Dash 1 amendment took on two issues. The first one would have resolved the county's requirement of or the penalty for not being able to receive and work with electronic fund transfers. And the second issue, which is in the Dash 1 amendment from line 9 down, was the issue with the Representative Boquist brought about the income tax for the Department of Revenue. Since then, this Dashon amendment was not to answer both issues together. So we asked Legislative Council to reintroduce those amendments in different ways. We have the Dash 2 amendment, and that Dash 2 amendment basically takes care of the issue for the Department of Revenue and electronic fund transfers of the tax payments and tax refunds. And I believe that this language in the Dash 2 addresses this issue that was discussed as acceptable in resolving the issue that was raised. But I think because of the Dash 1 experience, we somehow didn't want to include both amendments in the same amendment, so we have the Dash 3 amendment. And the Dash 3 amendment goes back to resolving the same first issue that we've talked about, which is the county's compliance and the penalty for failure to comply with the electronic funds. So those two amendments are passing of the Dash 1, but in different ways of further trying to resolve those issues.
Do we have anyone here by any chance from the counties on the Dash 3 amendments? I think they comply with where we were at previously and the concerns that have been expressed as I read the original Dash 1s. Oh, you have someone from the counties here? Would you like to come forward, please, and enter and sign in, identify yourselves, please, and have you had an opportunity to look at these Dash 3 amendments?
I have not, sir.
Okay. Are you prepared to discuss the Dash 3 amendments?
I believe it's probably relatively short.
Okay, go ahead. Here's your name.
Okay. James Morales, Benton County Clerk, on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks.
And usually we see your clerk here from Benton County. She's very active, James. So you're coming here in her stead?
I am the clerk.
Oh, you are
Benton
the clerk.
County. Yes.
Let's see. Who is it? Oh, it's your county commissioner that we see that's here frequently. I beg your pardon, James.
Okay.
Did you get a copy of the 2030?
No.
Do you want a copy?
Do you have a copy?
I think, Mazin, this conforms with the concerns that the county commissioners and the clerks association brought forward before.
That's what I'm thinking, Mr. Chair. Legislative Council have to take.
Was it Linda Madrill that was from Benton County that had discussed this with us before? So.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist, please.
The previous testimony was the Yamhill County Clerk.
Yamhill County Clerk.
Yes, sir.
That's part of your district, isn't it, Representative?
Affirmative.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist, is this, that's right, Jan Coleman. Thank you. Does this conform, Representative Boquist, the best of your recollection with what we've discussed?
I'm reading as we speak, Mr. Chair. Representative Riley and I reviewed Dash 2 with Deborah Buchanan, and Dash 3 was a news to me at this day. So
okay.
Give me a minute.
All right. Thank you. And that's correct. As I recall, I think we assigned the two of you to a special committee of two, a special subcommittee of two, to make sure that this got done correctly, so that we weren't going to do anything on this bill until Representatives Riley and Boquist were satisfied. James, have you had an opportunity to take a look at the Dash 3 to the 2030?
Chair Butler, yes, I have had that opportunity, and it appears to have the content which what we're looking for and concerned about.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me here.
Thank you, James. And I didn't mean to get you mixed up with Linda Madrill. You don't look anything like her, so.
Chair, I do have a question.
Representative Boquist.
Since Representative Ryan and I did review this, I don't know, and you may have said it, that we did review the Dash 2 amendment with Deborah, and I guess we're assuming that the Department of Revenue does concur with the Dash 3 amendment.
And Deborah doesn't have a copy of it with her, so she'll look at James' copy. And Representative Boquist, you and Representative Riley were satisfied with the Dash 2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I sat down and we reviewed and we actually researched the ORS statutes that are cited in the Dash 2 amendment, and then coordinated that with Deborah Buchanan to both of our satisfaction it met the interpretation that was discussed in the committee.
Thank you very much. Deborah, did you want to address Dash 3 amendment by any chance? It's been approved by... Fine, thank you very much. I will then... The chair is looking for a motion relative to the 2030-2, and Representative Boquist now moves 2030-2 amendment to House Bill 2030. Colleagues, is there any discussion relative to the pending of the Dash 2 amendment dated 2-14-05 to the House Bill 2030? Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, we will append the Dash 2 amendments. Representative Riley now moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2030. Colleagues, is there any discussion relative to the appending of the Dash 3 amendment to 2030? Hearing and seeing none, we will... is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, we will order the Dash 3 amendments to 2030. The chair now seeks a motion from the potential carrier of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Why does nobody look at me when I say
that? I would like to recommend Mr. Representative Boquist. I think he's well familiar with this. So.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to volunteer to carry this bill and to make a motion if you would such entertainment.
Representative Boquist now moves 2030 as amended with the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Colleagues, is there any discussion relative to that motion? No discussion whatsoever. Any objection to moving 2032 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended and as A engrossed? Hearing and seeing none, we will so order that. And Representative Boquist, you will be so kind. Thank you very kindly to carry that to the floor. We will close the work session on 2030. I will now open I will reopen the work session on Senate Bill 341. And Representative Berger. Representative Berger? Representative Berger now moves that we...
Open, that we allow Representative Haas to vote on this motion.
Representative Berger moves that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Haas to vote on Senate Bill 341. Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Haas, how do you vote on Senate Bill 341?
Aye.
Representative Haas votes aye. That's a unanimous aye. Any further discussion on 341? Hearing and seeing none, we will close the work session on 341. We will open a work session on House Bill 3452. Work session 3452 authorizes pass-through entities. I'm sorry, 2452 authorizing pass-through entities to file composite tax returns on behalf of non-resident individuals, corporations, and trusts. That's an extra set of those, Madison. I've got my set. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You got them.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Got them.
Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler, we heard this before with House Bill 2452. Nothing has changed in your packet or anything, but basically what the bill is doing is allowing pass-through entities to file a composite personal income or corporate excise tax return with the Department of Revenue on behalf of those non-resident owners who are choosing to be part of that composite return. And then basically it goes through and specifies that the composite return must include at least one non-resident owner, outlines the components that will be included in the composite return. Basically, it is allowing an electing owner to file a non-resident personal income tax or corporate excise tax for the tax year in which the owner was part of that composite return and be given credit for any tax that is paid on his or her behalf by the pass-through entity. It outlines the conditions under which a pass-through entity shall withhold income taxes for non-resident owners' distributive income. And so I think this was the main tax change that was part of this bill and the biggest component of this 2452. So it is requiring pass-through entities to withhold taxes on that distributive income from their non-resident owners. It'll be given to them for the owners that are not electing to be part of that composite tax return.
Elizabeth,
and
Hunter,
that's different under current law.
Thank you. Under issues discussed, I just encourage us to go ahead and include the discussion which we had relative to the multi-state tax commission.
That's
and
right.
Conformity to the multi-state tax commission of which Oregon participates. I think that's an important part of that for our House floor members to recognize. Any questions of Elizabeth? Okay. Colleagues, I would then entertain a motion that House Bill 2452 be moved to the full floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass amendment, or due pass recommendation without amendment.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
It's been moved that House Bill 2452 moved to the full House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We will go ahead and move House Bill 2452 to the full House of due pass recommendation. Any discussion relative to a consent calendar on that?
I would not.
Not do it on consent?
I would not.
Okay, no motion for consent.
I'll carry it.
We will then go ahead and ask Representative Berger to carry House Bill 2452 on the floor of the House of Representatives. If you would, please,
Representative. I will be happy.
We will close the work session on 2452. I will now open a work session for the potential of introducing committee bills to the House of Representatives. Colleagues, you have before you LC 2258 and 2357. Which you want to do first, Wilfa? 2258 is a relates to small fractional forest land taxation. And 2357. I know something about this one. Colleagues, 2357 is one that basically is a joint resolution which could come back to this committee at some particular point in time, which would allow the imposition of a uniform statewide tax on the manufacture, importation, and the distribution sale of malt beverages in the state of Oregon. It could allow that uniform imposition of tax on the manufacture, importation of the beverages in the state, and the state tax, that would be in addition to any state tax, would be a local tax to provide revenues to local jurisdictions. Now, colleagues, I need to let you know that there is a committee that's meeting right now on the potential of devolution of certain services. That's the potential that counties will take over more of the services which we have been taxing for and trying to provide at the state level, and the counties feel that they can deliver those services more effectively and more cost-effectively, more efficiently, but they would need an independent source before they would agree to go ahead and take those over, much like the Senate Bill 1145, which deals with the community corrections. When they have the rug pulled out from underneath of them, that makes it very difficult. So if they had their own resources. So this opens a method by which we can at least discuss that. I don't know that this has any life to it, but this LC was printed at my request. I would now entertain a motion that LC 2357 be introduced as a committee bill to the House or through the House Committee on Revenue.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
It's been moved that 2357 be introduced as a committee bill from the House Revenue Committee. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. LC 2258, Paul.
Mr. Chair, LC 2258 is a modification to the forest land taxation reform that many of you participated in the 2001 and then later in the 2003 session on the small tract forest land assessment. What this does is provide some additional flexibility on the filing procedure by changing the date on that filing procedure.
Representative Berger?
Question, Paul. I remember this from last session. It was quite complex. This is something that we didn't do or didn't do.
Representative Berger, what this does is just change the time frame on the filing. It doesn't alter the process itself. It changes the date for greater flexibility.
Okay.
Further discussion? Questions of staff? I'm seeking then a motion. Representative Berger now moves the LC 2258 be introduced as a committee bill from the House Committee on Revenue. Colleagues, any discussion in that regard? Any objection? Representative Comp?
Just a clarification that, as what Representative Berger stated, that this was something that has been approached, and yet is there, for Paul, is there... The application late fee is $200 or 0.1%. Was that the same as before in the previous bill on page 3, line 12?
First of comp, I believe what the bill does, that is new language. What it does is it's a fee if you don't meet.
Right, the deadline.
So it established a deadline, and it says if you don't meet this, then you've got to pay this fee.
But this is in addition to the previous bill.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes, it would be.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Boquist.
I do have. Is there a group of benefactors that? I mean, this bill didn't come out of.
I'm
Paul,
sorry.
Paul's goodwill.
I don't remember.
There was a work group.
There was
a huge work group that worked.
That was for the original bill, but in terms of this one, I'm not sure if this is not from the Department of Revenue. It may be from the counties.
Did you work on that interim?
I worked on that, not in the interim, but last. And I have no objection to this being entered as a committee bill, but certainly the folks that were involved in it from the get-go will probably note this, and we most certainly
like to hear from them.
We can be pretty sure of that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion that this be moved forward as a committee introduced bill on behalf of the House Committee on Revenue? Hearing and seeing no objection, we will go ahead and order that printed on behalf of the Committee on Revenue. Colleagues, that finishes my calendar for the day. I think it gives us a couple of minutes to get back to our offices and go about the rest of the work. I appreciate your attendance here today. Can we leave any business unfinished? I think not. We will go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow.
No more signatures.